В Москве убит известный политик Борис
убийство Бориса Немцова прошло чуть более
недели. Кто в самом центре Москвы?
Борис Ефимович Немцов убит, подтверждается.
Сообщили, что одна из пуль попала в сердце Бориса Немцова.
Год назад в Москве убили моего друга Бориса Немцова.
He was a young, path-breaking provincial governor in the heady days following the Soviet collapse. He was a reformist deputy prime minister, and in the eyes of many, a potential president. He was an uncompromising opposition leader who refused to be co-opted and who persevered even when it appeared that nobody was listening. And a year ago this weekend, Boris Yefimovich Nemtsov became a martyr. In many ways, Boris Nemtsov represents the path not taken in Russia. But what is his legacy? And did his hopes for his country die with him on that fateful chilly Moscow night last February? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University and expert on Russia security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
Good to see you again. And also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is Mark Bennett, author of the recently published book, I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War on Russia's Opposition. Welcome to the podcast, Mark. Good to have you on.
Hi, good to be here.
So it's really hard to believe it's already been a year, but it has. And as I noted on the Daily Vertical yesterday, it's pretty telling that they are naming streets after Nemtsov in Kyiv and in Vilnius, while in Moscow, pro-Kremlin activists are vandalizing makeshift memorials to Nemtsov that have been set up. Not only have the Ukrainians and Lithuanian capitals honored Nemtsov, but this week in Vienna, 10 delegations from the OSCE held an event to honor his memory. Meanwhile, in Nemtsov's hometown of Nizhny Novgorod, efforts to erect a memorial have fallen flat, as have efforts in Moscow to rename the bridge where he was killed. Let's start really broad. What was Nemtsov's legacy in Russia? Does Nemtsov have a legacy in Russia? Mark Bennett, let's start with you, since this is your first time on the podcast, and we got kind of a tradition. First time on the podcast, you get the first question. It's going to be confusing because there's two Marks, so I'm going to have to use your last names, which is going to be kind of weird, but that's okay. But yeah, Mark Bennett, what is Nemtsov's legacy in Russia, and does he indeed have a legacy?
Well, I mean, I think perhaps Nemtsov's real legacy, or perhaps his most important legacy, as far as the opposition is concerned, is the youngish kind of opposition members who were very inspired by him. People like Ilya Yashin, for example, the incredibly brave activist who recently, just very recently, presented a report on the ruthless Chechen leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, and corruption and possible involvement in politically motivated murders. I mean, Yashin's made no secret of his admiration for Nemtsov. They were very close friends, so I think the fact that he was so inspired as him is he even said, I spoke to him the other day in a cafe in Moscow, and he even said he intends to continue the work that Nemtsov began. He sees that as his mission for the next few years, at least. So, I mean, I think Yashin is just a living legacy, perhaps, of Nemtsov. And also, I mean, other activists as well, people like Polina Nemirovskaya, the young Open Russia activist who hounded, I think perhaps that's the only word we can use, Artyom Chaika, the son
of the prosecutor, yeah.
Yeah, Russia's prosecutor general. And she's also spoken, I think, in Geneva the other day about her admiration for Nemtsov and how he inspired her to be more, perhaps, how he inspired her to fight for the Russia that she wants to see. So, I mean, these people who have made no secret of their admiration for him and his role in shaping their political visions, that's perhaps his most important legacy. And also, he was maybe unequaled on uniting, or at least seeking to unite the opposition in Russia. I mean, for example, he was one of the only few figures from the opposition who attended the trial of Sergei Udaltsov, the hard left leader. I mean, politically, they had nothing in common at all. Yeah? Mm-hmm. But he tried to reach out to the hard left. And that's perhaps what made him so dangerous to the Kremlin as well. And when we'll see tomorrow as well, when Russians rally in his memory, that again, his even in his death, he's managed to bring them together. I mean, tomorrow there'll be nationalists, there'll be leftists, there'll be liberals, there'll be people from all across the anti-Putin political spectrum.
So the legacy is this man who was in his 50s when he was killed, and he's inspiring people who are in their 20s and 30s. So his legacy is that of a symbol.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, of course, I mean, it's it's always tempting when someone's murdered in such a manner and to over romanticize and perhaps over exaggerate his significance as well. I mean, obviously, while for Russian opposition activists, he's a very, very important figure, but for the mass of ordinary Russians, I'd say he's still associated mainly with the 1990s and the economic hardships. And it was striking, actually, that at the beginning of the 2011 protests, the unprecedented protests that broke out in December 2011 against Putin's rule, that state TV, whenever it deemed to mention these protests, routinely led with Boris Nemtsov. Yeah? They didn't mention Navalny, who was like perhaps more, well, a lot more popular, I would say. Yeah, or Udaltsov, who was perhaps a lot more dangerous. Yeah? Right. Or Nemtsov. So, at the time, when I was walking around talking to ordinary people, they were like, it's Nemtsov, Kasyanov. Yeah? Just people who were, perhaps wrongly or rightly, associated with the hardships experienced by millions and millions of Russians.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that is true. They tried to lay the tag of the 90s on him, but Nemtsov was one of the few figures in government in the 90s who kind of emerged with his reputation unscathed in terms of any specific allegations that he was benefiting from his position. He was very popular as governor of Nizhny Novgorod. I was living in Russia at the time, and he was, in his time as deputy prime minister until the 1998 ruble crash, he was quite popular as deputy prime minister, and at that time was seen, and this sounds like science fiction now, but at that time he was seen as a potential successor to Yeltsin.
In 1997, he had 50% rating generals as potential presidential candidate. So yeah, I mean, there was always the possibility he could have followed Yeltsin as president. And it's like it's state TV which uses him to blacken the name of the protest movement. It's also, of course, state TV which built up this reputation that then used against him. So.
Yeah, no, and I do remember how state TV built him up in the 90s as well as the private television channels, most notably NTV. Mark Galeotti, what are your thoughts? What is Nemtsov's legacy, and does he indeed have one?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because myths are almost by definition political Rorschach inkblot tests in which we read what it is we're looking for. So precisely for the activists, he's indeed an inspiring figure. Though, you know, most of the activists we're talking about were people who were already in the movement. It's not like actually there is a huge influx. There has been some people, but then there's also been people who are scared away by his death. So it's a little bit hard to know where the swings and roundabouts sort of add up. Whereas likewise to ordinary Russians, it doesn't really matter whether he actually was a deeply corrupt privatizer and so forth or not. Just simply being associated with the 90s. Once it's given this luster by official television, was enough to make him an unpopular figure. And in that respect, I mean, perversely, I'd actually want to point in three ways in which, as it were, the legacy not so much of Nemtsov but of his killing may well come back to haunt the Kremlin. I mean, one is that Nemtsov represented, in some ways, I would say, a vulnerability for the opposition. Precisely because he seemed like a throwback to an era that is so roundly despised. And therefore, as long as he was there as the most visible figure within the opposition, then the opposition could be painted in certain light. Second thing is, as we've discussed on many occasions, I mean, it's clear that Kadyrov, whether immediately or at slight arm's length, was behind this killing. The fact that he did get away with murder is actually also a bad thing for the Kremlin, in the sense of it has created considerable disquiet, even within its usual support base and indeed within the security apparatus as well. It at best makes the Kremlin look unable to control Kadyrov. At worst, it makes it look as if it's in bed with this murderous lunatic. And the third element, I would say, is the political impact of this killing, and the very fact that precisely there is now a year on protests which are precisely going to unite a whole variety of different people, different types of protesters, different types of political figures, that there is still the passion to keep trying that, sort of maintain the shrine on the bridge and rename it and such like. In some ways, and it's awful to be thinking in these terms, but it makes the next murder that much harder to envisage. The political impact of another killing, I think, would be that much greater. It was terrible the first time round, But if there's another killing, then that really will start getting a lot of people worried within the elite, because exactly, it will seem as if what otherwise can has been slightly explained away as a bizarre anomaly caused by a bloodthirsty figure from the North Caucasus. If it happens again and there is no meaningful impact, then that'll actually say something really rather different about control. I think there are impacts, yeah.
Mark Bennett, jump in here.
It's not, of course, the first time it's happened that Kadyrov has already been linked to politically motivated killings of opposition figures, opposition journalists. Of course, none of them with
Nemtsov's stature.
I think we're talking about that's something that is significant, and also I think something that actually even everyone within the elite is willing pretty much to admit that it was Kadyrov. Mm-hmm. Right from the get-go. I mean, this has been it's not like, it emerged. Pretty much everyone knew from the get-go.
It was remarkably fast how quickly the consensus among Nemtsov's allies, journalists, and official Moscow converged around that narrative.
And being leaked left, right, and center by officials.
Yeah. Something I'd like to point out, the irony of the tagging Nemtsov with the 90s, the taint of the 90s. People forget that Putin was in government throughout the 90s and enriched himself to say the least, to a greater extent than the likes of Nemtsov did. So there's a bit of hypocrisy in that. Mark Bennett, you wanted to jump in with something here?
But he's kind of painted himself into a corner, right, you know, because, I mean, as you say, it's generally accepted he had at least something to do. Yeah? I mean, there was at least some kind of approval coming from Kadyrov over Nemtsov's killing. So with his escalating threats against Kasyanov and to an extent Navalny. I mean, if he limits it now just to throwing cakes at Kasyanov, it's going to leave him looking kind of, I don't know.
Well, this is what worries me. I mean,
shot Nemtsov and threw cakes at Kasyanov. There doesn't seem any logic to it. You know?
No, one has to wonder if these cakes aren't a harbinger of something. The one with Kasyanov could have been thrown off as a childish prank. Now that they've done the same thing to Navalny, I'm getting a little bit nervous about that. In preparation,
Kasyanov hasn't insulted personally, as far as I'm aware, though Kadyrov, whereas Nemtsov did here, and Politkovskaya did as well. They both made very personal insults against Kadyrov, which perhaps in the world of the Chechen elite or in the world of I hate to say in Chechnya, but in the Caucasus, where personal insults should probably be avenged, by certain people. And Nemtsov famously said that Kadyrov was mentally ill and should be sent to an insane asylum. So, I mean, we don't know.
No, I'm a little bit nervous this weekend, actually, on a lot of this work. In preparing for this podcast, I went back and listened to the interview Boris Nemtsov gave to Echo Moskvy, literally hours before he was killed. Now, this thing was all over the media right in the immediate aftermath of his assassination, but I decided just to give a listen to this, and I want to play for one clip from that, cuz it illustrates a point I want to make, and let's listen to a clip from that interview from 1 year ago.
Let's just imagine a debate between me and Putin. I would start with a simple question. Why are Russian soldiers being killed, while you, Mr. Putin, as commander-in-chief, disown these soldiers and keep lying about how they're not in combat? We see the graves of these soldiers in Kostroma, in Pskov, and in Nizhny Novgorod, where I served as governor. As commander-in-chief, why do you disown your own soldiers? You have no right to be commander-in-chief after that.
Now, here we have Nemtsov imagining a debate with Putin and what he would say. And this, again, it shows, I mean, going back to this theme of the 90s. In the 90s, there was political debate. And Nemtsov is hearkening back to that era almost in imagining how he would eviscerate Putin in a debate about lying about the presence of troops and disavowing his troops who are fighting in Ukraine. And this got me thinking in a lot of ways, and I noted this in the intro, I noted it in the Daily Vertical this morning. Nemtsov in a lot of ways is the road not taken in Russia. He's the road of not that was not taken. I mean, I considered him one of the better figures in the 90s when I was living in Russia and he was in government. I considered him probably the best of the bunch. And now he's in, for him, the 90s wasn't the era of robber baron capitalism. It was the era of democratic pluralism. And he's hearkening back to this in a lot. And again, this is the road not taken. Can Russia go back down that road? Is that possible now? Mark Galeotti, why don't you?
Well, I think we have to be wary of romanticizing. I mean, the 90s was actually, in my opinion, a horrible decade. There was the semblance of political pluralism, but there was also the shelling of the parliament building, which admittedly a very unpleasant parliament, but still, you don't shell it. There was an election that was basically stolen. Fine. Would I have wanted to see President Zyuganov being inaugurated? Absolutely not. But still, the point is, you cannot steal elections and rewrite retrospectively the Constitution and think of yourself as being in some democratic idyll. In this respect, unfortunately, Putin is the child of the 1990s. So it's not about going back and creating some other road.
But when I say the road not taken, I mean that wasn't what Nemtsov's 90s were about. The 90s was about something else.
I mean, this is not a person who had a problem with the 90s as they really were. I think this is, in a way, my issue is that the same way let's be honest, I mean, Nemtsov, and it's very difficult, obviously, when we're talking about someone who had, you know, such extraordinary courage and charisma and died in such a terrible way, to then feel as if you're in any way sort of disparaging. But nonetheless, he was no longer a significant figure in Russia's future. Even, I mean, Gennady Gudkov called him the sort of the moderator. Well, he failed to bring together the opposition movement, unfortunately. And again, this is not a criticism of him specifically. I don't know who could have done the job. But the thing is, precisely that there was no way that one could go back to the 90s, because the 90s was not something that was either a particularly wonderful model for most people, nor was it a coherent model. The 90s was such a mishmash.
Hold on, let me rephrase, because I'm not talking about going back to the 90s. That's not what I had in mind. I had in mind, when I say the path not taken, a place where genuine political debate actually happened and had meaning. Because that's what Nemtsov was basically fantasizing about in this clip I just played, a debate with Putin today is out of the question. It ain't going to happen, right? But there was a time when that was not so crazy an idea, and it's something that could happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in that respect, I mean, you know, Nemtsov was. I mean, I think we can agree in actually foreshadowing. I mean, again, as you know, I'm in the long term. I'm very much an optimist about Russia's prospects.
I know. I thought I was throwing you a softball here.
Well, as I said, as soon as you start throwing in the 90s, I get a little bit more twitchy. But so, I mean, I think in a way, Nemtsov's tragedy was that he was born 20 odd years too early. The values for which he came to espouse, and again, I think, you know, we have to realize everyone evolves. Nemtsov, as I see him, was one who had certain values, and he tempered those with a certain pragmatism in office, that he had to swallow what he felt was the best of the available options. And in a way, his tragedy was actually that, unfortunately, he had a relatively narrow range of available options. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, he stood for open debate. He stood for not just debate, but actually a realm of politics that was both meaningful, but also institutionalized. Because this is in many ways a tragedy of the 90s, and certainly a tragedy of the Putin era, is that we have seen even the presidency become deinstitutionalized and meaningless. Politics has just simply become cabals of important people who happen to know each other or are next door neighbors. That was something that started in the 1990s. And that was a realm of politics that actually, although Nemtsov was clubbable and everything else, but he was not that kind of politician. Right. Which is why ultimately there was, you know, even putting aside whether he would have been willing to protect the family and everything else, ultimately, he, in my opinion, he would never have been able to be the next president, because even under Yeltsin, we had this realm of politics emerge, which is about these corrupt kleptocrats operating regardless of rather than through institutional structures.
I can't help but recall listening to you, Mark, a conversation I had with Nemtsov on the night Putin was elected the first time back in March of 2000. It was at a reception in the United States Embassy. And I walked over to Nemtsov and asked him because his party had supported Putin. And I asked him about this and why he said to me, God, I hear Putin's going to close down Entebbe. He said this. And I said, God, Boris Efimovich, your party supported this man. And he looked at me and all the cockiness, and anybody that's ever dealt with Nemtsov knows this cockiness, and it all went out of his face, and he was like, no, Brian, что мне делать? You know, what could I do? And it was this kind of gets to this somebody who has values, but these values were tempered by pragmatism. And I think this illustrates it. Mark Bennett, we haven't heard from you in a bit. Why don't you jump in? Your thoughts on what Mark and I are...
As I said, I mean, it's important to remember that Nemtsov was very, very supportive of the Putin presidency. He even wrote a co-ed in the New York Times where Russia could do considerably worse than have a leader with an unwavering commitment to the national interest. And obviously, it's difficult to see how we could do better. And as you say, the fact that he didn't criticize Putin was mainly because of the presence of Chubais in his party.
Yes, it was a battle. As you point out in your book, this is a fight between him and Chubais over this. Chubais was all for supporting Putin. In fact, he was one of the instrumental people in getting Chubais to be the successor, is my understanding of it. Another thing I wanted to... Go ahead.
It's pointless just now. I'm speculating right now what an empty presidency, if it come about, would have looked like. But I mean, I'm not too sure it would have been so great for the majority of the Russian people, ordinary Russian people. You have to remember, this is a man whose favorite politician, I think he once said, was Margaret Thatcher. I mean, you can say what you want about Margaret Thatcher, but I don't think Russians at that time were particularly ready for Thatcherite politics and for shock economic therapy.
No, but in his defense, actually, in his time in government as deputy prime minister, he was trying to reform the bloated and corrupt energy sector. He failed. He failed in his battle with then Gazprom chief Rem Vyacharev. If I remember those fights, though, he was trying to rein in the oligarchic capitalism, but he was up against a brick wall. I mean, again, and gets back to this whole idealism and values tempered by pragmatism. His time in Nizhny Novgorod was, I think, as close to an unqualified success as you can get in the 90s, though. I mean, it was considered by far and away the most reformist region. I visited it a number of times during his governorship there, and and the region did seem to work much better than other Russian regions. I want to shift to another point that kind of jumps out at me about Nemtsov, and one of the things that I think is also part of his legacy, and this is the perseverance in the face of indifference and against impossible odds. I mean, this is one of the things that impressed me about him. I mean, let's face it. When Putin came to power, he could have found his nice, comfortable spot in the Putin system. Others from the 90s did. Chubais did. Kirienko did. Alexei Kudrin did. A lot of these people from the 90s found their spot in the Putin constellation, so to speak. Nemtsov didn't. He chose to go to the street at the end of the day. Even, yes, he did write that op-ed. But as soon as he really got a sense of what this regime was all about, he wanted no part of it. And I have to give him credit for that, because even when Putin's, his popularity was in the stratosphere and nobody was listening to Nemtsov, he persevered. I want to play another clip from this debate, this interview that Nemtsov gave to Echo Moskvy just hours before his death, where he was trying to get people to come out to a peace march against the war in Ukraine, which was supposed to take place on March 1st of last year, 2 days after Nemtsov was killed. Let's listen to this clip.
I don't want to lie. Putin is our expert at lying. He is a pathological liar. I don't want to lie. I want to speak the truth. This march can change the situation in the direction of peace. This march can sober up the Kremlin. And gradually, not with a single march. We can change the political direction of our country.
I mean, it's hard to listen to that clip and not be impressed that he actually believed it, whether it's delusional or not. Whether it's delusional or not, the man believed. The man believed that he could change things through the sheer force of people power. Mark, your reaction, Galeotti.
Yeah, exactly. I think that... In some ways, I think that the sort of the greatest legacy of Nemtsov's are twofold. One is precisely this willingness to continue against what were clearly ludicrously extreme odds. You know, actually, it got harder and harder and harder to mobilize and to feel that you actually could have traction on the political system. So, I mean, I think a political optimism and willing to actually put himself on the line. And combined with that, though, a sense that the people are actually of the same opinion as him. And this is an extraordinarily elitist thing to say, but I am who I am. But, I mean, I think in fairness, at this, certainly by that point, Nemtsov was well ahead of even the Muscovite population, let alone the Russian population. And yet, whereas a lot of people within the opposition, whatever they may say in public, actually do have a sense that there is this kind of lumpen proletariat of Russians that somehow has to be ignored or completely have their opinions changed. I think Nemtsov also retained a certain optimism of spirit about the Russian people, and that he actually thought that if only he could get through to them, in fact, they would respond and that politics could be changed. So you might say it was both a personal optimism that he could continue and do things and actually change it, but also a wider optimism about the Russian people.
Yeah, in this sense, he was a liberal in the classical sense. I mean, he did believe that in a free marketplace of ideas, the best ideas would win. He obviously believed his ideas were the better ideas. And so in this sense, if the Russian people could just hear the truth, go back to that clip where he's talking about debating Putin. And if you watch it on the video, I mean, he's almost relishing this opportunity because he knows his argument is so strong. And so it's, again, this is somebody who was in a lot of sense, and you mentioned Margaret Thatcher. Well, yeah, he was a classical liberal in that sense. Mark Bennett, your thoughts.
I don't know if you talk about Nemtsov's stubborn opposition and perseverance. I think we also have to recall that within the opposition for a time, he was actually considered a traitor by a lot of the more radical members, because in December 2011, when the initial protest, anti-election protest, was due to take place on Revolution Square, which is a slap bang between the State Duma and the Kremlin, which would have been very hard for the authorities to control, and which could have led to a kind of Maidan situation quite easily, he was among the... two or three protest leaders who agreed and actually negotiated to move the protest to Bolotnaya Square, which was far easier for authorities to control. From the first moment you were there, it was clear nothing was going to happen apart from a lot of very nice speeches. But if it had taken place at Revolution Square, who knows what would have happened?
Right, and the authorities didn't want it.
Who knows what kind of Russia we would have today? I mean, that was a very unpredictable time. You know, if you'd had 40, 50,000 people right next to Red Square, right next to the Kremlin, anything could have happened. And so, in a sense, when push came to shove, he said he didn't want to. He said his quote was, "Putin's not worth the blood of even one of our comrades," which is kind of ironic now. At the time, I mean, it's debatable whether it was a correct decision or not, because there would have been deaths probably, and there would have been a lot of injuries, and there would have been a lot of people who'd never been on protests before, like he said, beaten around the head by the Amon.
Right.
And he said there's something he wanted to avoid. Then again, you have to ask. Who was he to make that decision for the mass of ordinary people as well? You know, I mean, no one was doing it at Maidan. No one was saying, "Nah, you can't go there. It's too dangerous. You know, stay back. This is for the professional activists." I mean, revolutions don't happen unless you have hundreds, tens of thousands of people in the center.
Yeah, and I think he again, this was the pragmatism coming, the inherent pragmatism of the man. Mark, there's another thing that jumped out at me in your book about it. You talked about, I mean, and anybody that knows Nemtsov can appreciate this immediately, is his personal style. You said when you recounted this anecdote when you went to meet him, and he's really gruff and he talks to you using the familiar T form, and then when you, which is true, I mean, in a lot of ways he's like a Russian version of a New Yorker in a lot of ways, which is a Northeasterner in the U.S. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. I see that as a compliment. But the man was very earthy. You also noted when he shifted to English, he suddenly became, it was like velvet. He suddenly...
Well, I was interested to see. I was thinking, how did he convince U.S. congressmen to adopt the Magnitsky Act? I mean, you can't talk to congressmen. I imagine like that, you know, the way like, he's like, come here, right. And asked him, and he was, yes, of course we can speak English.
It just shifts
immediately.
It's striking because I watched not only this interview he gave to Echo Moskvy shortly before his death, but an interview he gave to CNN in Moscow back in 2014, and it's the contrast in the styles of the Nemtsov speaking English and the Nemtsov speaking Russian is really, really remarkable. But it's the Nemtsov speaking Russian that the Russian public sees, and it is this very earthy. He doesn't come across like this pompous intellectual from the capital. He comes across very earthy, and didn't this endear him to a degree to the population? Because the man is charming. I mean, in a really charming in a very gruff way.
Well, I mean, for many years, you have to remember, of course, he wasn't allowed. No one really saw him speak, you know, for a very long time, unless you were going to protest meetings. So I mean, he was barred from state TV.
Right, until the emergence of Dosh. Well, he was on Echo all the time.
Yeah, but not okay.
Mark, any thoughts on this? Galeotti.
I think, I mean, I'd agree that he had that sort of clear, you know, a charisma that put him sort of, it meant that in some ways he could bridge two different aspects. There was a sort of a certain old style of liberal reformer who precisely was much more intellectual and distant from the masses. And then there was a newer, younger generation, many of whom, doesn't mean they're any less intellectual, but they understood the need to be able to reach out. And obviously Navalny is the archetype of that. And precisely what was interesting about Nemtsov was his capacity to bridge those. He could be at once an elder statesman without anything elderly about him.
Right.
It was also admirable as well how, when it was clear that Navalny was becoming the opposition figurehead and he was the new how he just stepped aside and helped.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was really graceful. I thought that was...
For example, Limonov, yeah? I mean, Limonov was the opposition, pretty much, yeah, for many years. I'm with Nemtsov, yeah? But
and Kasparov.
And Kasparov, yeah, okay. And yeah, but I mean, he was one of the two or three faces of the opposition. But as soon as it was clear that Navalny was going to overtake them all, I mean, Limonov just lost it and went over to the Kremlin, you know?
Right, right.
Head of the opposition, I'll be head of the anti-opposition, you know?
So, no, I thought that was a telling moment.
Well, it was just like, yeah, I'll help. Yeah, you're more popular, you know?
No, it was very gracious, very magnanimous, and I thought very telling about the man's character.
I mean, in fairness, though, obviously, ideologically, they're actually also very similar, in a way that one certainly could not say about Limonov.
No,
in some ways, part of the reason for Limonov's hissy fit and so forth was actually, you might say, I think, seeing a window of opportunity of what the actual the center of gravity of the opposition movement would be. And obviously he had hopes to move it in a rather more kind of leftist and confrontational way, and seeing it essentially that a crown was being passed, and it was remaining in some ways Thatcherite, but let's just say sort of liberal, but in a sort of right-wing liberal economic as well as liberal political sort of sense, which clearly actually is pretty antithetical to Limonov's views.
Yeah, I would add to that, though, that Nemtsov didn't really share Navalny's nationalism. They shared values in other ways, but the nationalism was one thing that they were very different. They differed on. Let's shift gears to the second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and broaden the aperture a bit to look at how Russia has changed since the Nemtsov assassination. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is Mark Bennett, author of the recently published book, I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War on Russia's Opposition. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Выстрел в Немцова – это выстрел в России. Я думаю, что в этом...
Знаете, я не думаю, что что-то изменилось в том смысле, что...
Окружение Путина не прощают личные атаки на Путина.
Мы должны освободить Россию от Путина.
Vladimir Putin's all-out war on the opposition did not start with the Nemtsov assassination. It started, as you pointed out in your book, Mark, it started out with Putin's return to the Kremlin in May 2012. And in fact, there is little consensus as to whether the Nemtsov assassination was, in fact, part of Putin's war on the opposition. We're all still debating whether Kadyrov went rogue or whether he was acting with Putin's tacit consent and a nod and a wink. So what I asked the start of the first part with what is Nemtsov's legacy? Let's start the second with what is the legacy of his assassination? How has the atmosphere changed in the opposition in Russia over the past year? Is there fear? Has fear been weaponized as everything else? The Moscow Times had a subhead on their piece today about the Nemtsov assassination. Mark Bennett, let's start with you on that, since you wrote a whole book about this.
Well, obviously, of course, there's when one of your leading members of your movement is gunned down next to the Kremlin, obviously there's going to be a lot of fear among opposition leaders and activists. I was talking to Yashin the other day, and I was like, aren't you afraid? And he was like, do I look afraid? And I was like, a little bit. And he was like, a little bit is right, I am. But actually, I mean, I think after Nemtsov murder, it seems strange to my sound, a lot of the incredibly aggressive, hysterical kind of anti-opposition propaganda has kind of declined slightly. I mean, you have to remember, like, 2 or 3 days before Nemtsov was killed, the anti-Maidan organization movement rallied in central Moscow, calling basically for the murder of opposition members, for them to be exiled or destroyed or crushed or whatever. But after Nemtsov was killed, you don't hear so much about them anymore.
I mean, Kadyrov's still doing it.
Well, Kadyrov's still doing it, yeah. As I said, the only real exception is Chechnya, with the threat now from the opposition is becoming mainly, I would say, from Chechnya right now. So, of course, like, threats of putting the opposition in psychiatric asylums, calling them jackals, enemy of the people. But I also think that, in some ways, like, Nemtsov murder was something that perhaps even boosted in some way the confidence of the opposition movement, or gave them a kind of sense of solidarity, yeah, because they realized that the battle lines have been completely drawn, yeah. And so that they're kind of all in it together now, and there's nothing really they can do is have a fight until the end or leave Russia. Yeah? So, I mean, and when you place, it's kind of more of a moral struggle, I would say, now, rather than a political struggle for a lot of the activists. I mean, it's quite notable that a lot of the kind of rank and file activists who are out on the streets every day, not even affiliated with any of the parties. Yeah? I mean, you talked about their political views. They go, it's not even important what my political views are. What's important is that we have, like, normal elections, normal democracy, a normal country. Yeah? And then we can start talking about politics. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think in a way the Nemtsov murder just stressed that it's kind of a battle for Russia's soul.
So there's more
there's more fear, but there's also, I think, there's more solidarity. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of your leaders is gunned down, you come together or leave. Yeah? I mean, you may have to make a choice. Once you've made the choice to stay, that's it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're there. And, you know, I think a lot of them know they can rely on each other as well now, maybe to a greater extent than they could before.
Mark Galeotti, your thoughts?
Yeah, in some ways, from an opposition movement, the very, very worst thing is to be ignored, to be regarded as completely irrelevant. And therefore, exactly, all, you know, however horrifying and indeed scary the fact of Nemtsov's killing may be, it also said something, or, you know, people were able to read into it that sense that this is actually a real struggle. People don't bother killing, the rationale goes, if they don't fear you. And that sense that the otherwise implacable, irresistible, unchallengeable Kremlin might be afraid, or at least elements sort of within this sort of state apparatus might be afraid, is actually quite a strong endorsement in a way of the movement. Mm. So I think, again, exactly, I'd agree that there is this funny duality about the fear, that it is both demotivating and indeed motivating. Mm. And the other point I'd make, it isn't really just to sort of pick up again on this point that I made before, that I do feel that actually as a result, the state feels in some ways a little bit more constrained. This might seem perverse, given that people are still being arrested and prosecuted on the most flimsy of charges and so forth. You know, we wouldn't want to put it so far. But clearly, the Nemtsov killing broke the etiquette that it's one thing to beat up a journalist, or indeed kill a journalist, because, well, journalists are asking for it. It's one thing to deal with some small, low-level member of an opposition movement. But someone like Nemtsov was, in a way, was one of us. He was an apostate one of us, but he was one of us. And therefore, he should be out of bounds. And I think, therefore, you know, I think there's a lot of people who definitely, even people who had no personal sympathy for him or the opposition movement, but nonetheless were really very seriously taken aback. And that mood is one that I think has been noted within the Kremlin. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that an important line was crossed here. This was a former deputy prime minister, a former governor, a member of the elite, and they crossed a line by killing him. So that means they won't do it again?
Well, I'm not saying they won't do it again necessarily. That's a dangerous, though I'd love to be able to predict so, but I'm not quite so, unfortunately, either optimistic or incautious. But it's more that I think people sort of at the top of the system are much more aware of the political costs involved, that it's not just something that is going to possibly scare, possibly motivate just some bunches of opposition activists on the fringes of the system. There are people who, let's be honest, the majority of people within the upper elite are not ideological. They are entirely self-interested. And one of the things they rely on is a sense of the etiquette that actually, you know, if things go badly for you, yeah, you might lose a certain amount of money, but, you know, you're not going to get put in prison unless you've really gone against the Kremlin. And most importantly of all, you're certainly not going to get whacked. Mm-hmm. So even without actually thinking that the Kremlin did it, and most people don't, the very fact that the Kremlin was unable to stop this from happening, I think is something that actually, you know, has created a sense that if this kind of thing happens again, then people are going to get even more worried. And it'll give even more of a sense of either that the government is unable to control the killing, or has decided to renounce part of the implicit social contract. Mm.
Now, and there's something also that it's worth remembering, that, you know, what happened immediately or shortly after the Nemtsov assassination was Putin's absolutely bizarre disappearance from public view for a little over a week. Mark, you were in Moscow reporting at this time. I mean, I've read different theories about what was going on during Putin's big disappearance. What indications were you getting about what was going on there?
Honestly, I have no clue what happened. I have no idea what happened to Putin at all. I mean,
no, but what? But why? I mean, because he was having a razborka with Kadyrov. Kadyrov disappeared for a few of those days too. It was very strange. If you remember that time, there were rumors he was deathly ill. There was all sorts of crazy stuff popping around.
He could have been ill. He could have had a kind of Stalin kind of nervous breakdown, you know, bad news, and retired to the dacha for a while to drink or whatever, you know, thinking about what he was going to do next. He could have been overseeing meetings, negotiations between the FSB and Kadyrov, you know, because the FSB obviously wouldn't have been very pleased with Kadyrov carrying out brazen political killing on the streets of Moscow. And of course, there's no love lost between the FSB and Kadyrov either. So, I mean, it was just bizarre. I mean, there was a point when people were certainly thinking that something had happened to Putin, and that this was going to be a historical moment, that Putin was either not going to come back, that he was gone.
Right.
Some people, I mean, there was a tiny minority, of course, of activists who were worried that Kadyrov had made like a power play, and that we were going to wake up one morning and we were going to have prison Ramzan.
Right.
Or, at least head of a temporary government, an emergency government or something.
The system was going haywire, too, because there was no signals coming from the top about how people were supposed to act.
There was also that very interesting state news report where they reported Putin's meetings. He had a meeting set for Monday, I think, in Kazakhstan. And they reported in the past tense. It was Friday. It was supposed to take place on Monday. Putin met today on Monday with... And I was like, on. So there was definitely a sense that we kind of slipped into another reality.
And then there were reports of meetings that had happened, and then bloggers pointed out that the stuff was.
The trucks that turned up one night outside the Kremlin at about 11 o'clock and just stayed there for a few hours. And then, it was a
very bizarre time.
Points out how unstable the political situation is in Russia, despite all Putin's kind of talk of stability, the fact that. He goes, and no one knows what's going to happen.
No one knows what's going to happen. No, I remember writing on the blog at the time that Putin may or may not be sick, but what's going on at the time was a sign that the system certainly is very sick. You mentioned earlier in the podcast, Mark, Polina Nemirovskaya, and I think that's I want to play a clip actually from her speaking yesterday at the Geneva Human Rights Conference about her experience working on Boris Nemtsov's campaign for the Yaroslav City Council. So that she was speaking yesterday at a human rights conference. Let's listen to her now.
To be honest, until I met Boris Nemtsov, I never liked him. For me, he was just an ordinary figure from the 90s, and I was tired of seeing faces in politics that were there even before I was born. But that summer changed everything for me. Boris Nemtsov turned out to be very bright and very alive, and what's more important, he was sincere. He wanted the same for the country as I did, and he didn't seem to be making any profit from being an opposition leader. He just did what he thought was right, the same way as I did. Against all the odds, he won that campaign. And after that summer, I ended up with something more, with hope. It was very important to me to know that there are good and honest people between the leaders of protest in Russia. And even though I still didn't trust any other politicians, I had one to believe in.
I had one to believe in. I mean, this is telling. This woman's 20 years old. This woman's 20 years old. And she was saying, I didn't like this guy. And then I worked on his campaign and I got to know him and he gave me hope and he's the one I believe in. Now there's kind of two ways I can go on this, and I want to go both ways. Does the fact that he was able to win over this young woman who's young enough, certainly young enough to be his daughter, who wasn't even born when Nemtsov was in government. That's one way. And the other now is this hope dead? No, there's two ways. I guess whoever wants to jump in first and feels like it is free to do so.
For what it's worth, hope can't be dead. Yes.
Hope can't be dead. All right. What is the fact, Mark, that Nemtsov was able to win over this where there's one, there's potentially many. This is somebody who is now working in the human rights community, but who was educated to be a corporate lawyer and was working as an intern at Gazprom before she went to work for Nemtsov.
Well, yeah, Nemtsov was very charismatic, obviously. And I've heard other people say that, actually, other activists. I didn't like basically the same thing. I didn't like Nemtsov until I met him. Then I met him, talked to him, I realized he's just kind of sincere, genuine kind of guy. I probably had some of the stereotypes in my own head as well before I actually interviewed and sat down and met him. Really, he's very fun, a friendly guy, and very intelligent.
So this he was able to give hope to this person. I imagine he gave hope to others. And with the fact that ended up getting him dead, getting him killed. Mark, you say hope never dies.
But otherwise, why would there be the protests tomorrow?
Well, exactly.
I think, though, for me, it also emphasizes one of the tragedies of the opposition, which is, we talked about this in the past, their failure to institutionalize too. I mean, the fact was that, and obviously in this respect, Nemtsov is not sort of alone, but nonetheless, they had this extraordinary talent at their disposal, a man who precisely could reach out to a whole variety of different audiences. Speak and I don't just simply mean in terms of his actual language, but speak to values, to a whole variety of different types of people, and who was genuinely committed to building some kind of pluralistic political movement in which, again, to go what my namesake was saying, he was even willing to accept Udaltsov as being a sort of a a comrade in arms, however, at arm's length, rather than just simply, oh, this ghastly communist sort of guy or whatever. And yet, precisely because the opposition never managed to get their act together to actually have the kind of political machine that in a way could take him, his words to a wider audience. They depended on, fine, yes, there's Echo Moskvy, there's Deutsche Welle or whatever, as it were, channels that are already there. But they never truly managed to institutionalize, and therefore the trouble was, given that there was only one Nemtsov, he could only physically meet so many people. They failed truly to capitalize on his abilities in that respect. And that, for me, is a tragedy. But there will be others who, in different ways, can do the same thing.
I think they're also, the opposition, and I guess Nemtsov as well, are also unwilling to take that extra step. You know? I mean, it's illogical to hold protests and then ask the government for permission to hold another protest in a month's time. And then when they say no, say, okay, can we protest like in a month and a week and not in the same place you said, but a bit further out, you know? I mean, if the aim of a protest movement is to topple the government, I'm sorry, you're not going to topple the government like that. You topple the government like for right or wrong, as the protesters on Maidan did when they banned the protest. They went out the next day and protested again. Whereas in Russia, when they said, no, you can't protest, they said, okay, when can we?
Yeah, which is why the Kremlin was so nervous about the Maidan protests, which they had to demonize immediately. Before we wrap up, I wanted to just touch you touched on this a little bit earlier in the program, Mark Benz, about who is going to pick up the mantle. You mentioned Ilya Yashin, Navalny's name came up as well. I mean, Yashin seems to really be trying to seize the mantle right now. But who do you see as the leading lights right now? Is it those two? Is there anybody else in the wings?
Well, obviously Navalny is by far and away the leader of the opposition. I think he's the most popular member, and he's also the person as well with the potential to unite different spectrums. I mean, he can bring kind of more extreme national, quasi nationalists into the movement, and the liberals and the kind of like hipsters and the whole lot. You know, things with Yashin, I think he's incredibly brave, and he's probably, from speaking to all the opposition members, I mean, personally, I find him the most sensible in a way. I mean, the closest to a European kind of model of politics that I would like to see in Russia. He kind of has the most pro-European. I don't mean kind of pro-Western as in Thatcher. I mean, just as in a kind of like normal, kind of like, for me anyway, just kind of mindset. Which is, in a way, might be to his disadvantage in Russia. I don't know.
Sensible
politicians in Russia tend not to get much traction.
Yeah, he's in his early 30s, which was the age Nemtsov was when he entered politics as well during the 90s. Mark, last word to you. Future of the opposition movement, what do you see?
Well, look, the opposition movement is not going to topple the Kremlin. It's not even going to make a serious bite. Firstly, because I think that moment has passed. And secondly, because precisely we are not talking about a Maidan. And frankly, even if we had been talking about a Maidan, one thing this Kremlin understands is power. And they would be able to frankly defeat anything like that. Instead, it's going to actually have to come from the wider Russian people. It's going to come from the sort of the generic pinprick disgruntlements around the country. So what the opposition movement would have to do is not just simply find a new Nemtsov who can be hip in the West and popular amongst certain Moscow circles. It's actually to think how they can actually reach out and talk to people who up to now have never thought of themselves as oppositionists.
Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, has been Mark Bennett, author of the recently published book, I'm Going to Ruin Their Lives, Inside Putin's War and the Russian Opposition. I got my copy. You should get yours, too. Thank you to both Marks for an enlightening and lively discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian-language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.